Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. As you heard, schools, colleges, non-essential businesses are closed. Flights and cruises are canceled. Many Marylanders are staying home in order to stop the spread of the coronavirus, but infections continue. The Maryland Department of Health reported 288 cases of COVID-19 in the state as of 10 a.m. yesterday. That number will be updated again today. Three people in Maryland have died. How can the U.S. insurance system adapt to protect uninsured patients? How have limited tests impacted the severity of this crisis? My guest is Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, a pediatrician and associate dean for public health practices and training and professor of the practice at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He previously served as the health commissioner of Baltimore City, the principal deputy commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and the health secretary of the state of Maryland. Dr. Sharfstein, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What has been your reaction to this pandemic and Maryland's response?
Well, this is really the pandemic we've all been fearing. I mean, I think if you think back to SARS or H1N1, you know, there were really scary parts of both of those. SARS was so deadly and H1N1 spread so fast. But we both cases, we really got out of it because SARS didn't spread that well. And the flu, was it the H1N1 pandemic, was not actually that lethal. But this combines sort of both of those. It's certainly not quite as deadly as SARS, but it is very, very damaging to people. And obviously, older people particularly, very high risk for serious illness and death. And it has the ability to spread far more quickly than the flu. So you combine, easier spread and quite deadly, and you get this massive public health risk. So this is really serious. This is something that is going to change, you know, our society. But right now, we're just focused on getting through it.
Has Maryland's response been appropriate?
I think Maryland has done a very good job. I'm impressed with the governor. I think he's got a very good team. I know Fran Phillips, who's the Deputy Secretary for Public Health and has really been his lead point person, very well. We worked together at the state, and she was the Anne Arundel County Health Officer. I was in Baltimore City, and we worked well then. I can't really think of a better person I'd want in charge, and she is doing everything she possibly can. I think the state and the governor have been out in front on really realizing how severe this is, out in front, frankly, of the White House, and the seriousness, the serious measures, the restrictions, the social distancing, those are all critically important to buy us time. They're not going to, you know, buy us forever, but they're going to buy us time, and it's really important for us to use that time as well as possible.
I want to get your thoughts about where the guidance from the White House stands right now. At the briefing yesterday evening, Ambassador Deborah Birx, a physician and the response coordinator for the White House Coronavirus Task Force, emphasized the need for continued social distancing in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Each person has to be responsible in the way that they decrease their interaction with others, the 6 feet, and you're all very social distance, so thank you. But also assuming that everyone that you're interacting with could be positive.
But at the same time, President Trump promised, quote, America will again and soon be open for business, very soon, a lot sooner than 3 or 4 months that somebody was suggesting, close quote. What do you make of this?
So I teach a course called Public Health Crisis and Response at the School of Public Health, and I wrote a book called The Public Health Crisis Survival Guide, Leadership and Management in Trying Times. And the reason I did that is because I realized there was a gap in people thinking about how to step up and run a response when you have so much at stake. And there are some really important principles for that kind of a response. And one of them has to do with communications, that communications is so important. When there are challenges like this, pandemics, people are very worried. Understandably, they're anxious, they're afraid, and communications becomes the critical difference between whether people feel helpless and hopeless on the one hand, or whether they do the things that they need to do to keep themselves and their families and their communities safe. So communications is more than just explaining what's going on. It's part of what's going on. And one of the principles of communications is you need a clear and consistent and credible message. And I think we're really not getting that right now from the federal government. And what happens when you hear one thing one day and then later that afternoon a completely different message is people tend to grab on to the easiest message to understand. Think about it this way. If you're watching TV on one channel and they say something like, there's a tornado coming, you have to run down to the basement, you might turn the channel and if you know the next channel says, there's no tornado coming, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about, then you might be like, I'm not so worried about this. But if every channel says, there's a tornado coming, you're more likely to run down to the basement. And I think that what's happening right now is that different channels, sometimes it's the same podium, people are saying different things, and that can be confusing. It can make people not know what to do, and it can make people not take the steps that they really do need to take to protect themselves. So I'm very concerned, and I think it is not a great example for my course.
Could the states continue the current courses they've set for themselves, even if President Trump changes focus?
Well, I mean, I do think like the state of Maryland has been doing, for example, on communications much, much better. It's been a clear message. You've got not only a governor who's been very clear, but a fantastic public health official in Fran Phillips, who's able to also lay it out for people. So I think they are making up for some of the gap here in Maryland. But it's still confusing when there are federal officials saying different things. And there are other states which aren't at all like Maryland. They're public officials are still joking about the coronavirus. They will not be joking when people they care about get very sick. And it is very, very important for the nation to be responding, because we need the places that haven't seen that much of it to stay with as little of it as possible so supplies and other urgent things can go to the areas that are swamped. I mean, this is really a moment to figure out whether the country can come together, or is it just that people will kind of tune out until it's suddenly there, and by then it may be too late for them to get extra help.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with former Baltimore City Health Commissioner and former Maryland Secretary of Health, Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, about the COVID-19 pandemic. On Saturday, the Food and Drug Administration issued the emergency use authorization for a rapid COVID-19 test designed by the diagnostics company Cepheid. The test would deliver results in 45 minutes. How does the emergency use authorization process work? How does it differ from typical road to approval?
I definitely can answer that. So when I was at the FDA as the acting commissioner, I signed the first emergency use authorization that the FDA ever had. This is an interesting process. It really follows the 9/11 and the anthrax attacks when they realized that you couldn't just use the regular approval process, which, you know, has a bunch of different steps to make sure that medications are safe and effective according to a pretty high standard. You couldn't just use that in an emergency when time is of the essence. And you had to make some judgments about whether or not there's enough evidence. And so the way it works is instead of something being approved by the FDA, it's authorized in an emergency. And the standard in the law is that the potential benefits exceed the potential risks. So it's a pretty flexible standard. It's hard to imagine a more flexible standard. There's no requirement for any specific type of evidence. If the FDA feels that the potential benefits exceed the potential risks, then the agency can authorize a diagnostic test, like a PCR test, like the one you mentioned, or even a medication for use in that situation. So that particular test basically does the same thing. It looks for the virus. It does it a little faster than other tests, but I don't think it's going to fundamentally change the testing, because you still need a big machine to run that in, and there are only so many of them around. I do think testing that will become more available. What's interesting to me about testing is not so much doing the same type of test a little faster, but the fact that there are different kinds of tests now becoming available. And right now, the main test, like the one you mentioned, is looking for the presence of the virus. They're actually looking for the genetic material of the virus. There are new tests becoming available that look at the antibody response, whether someone's had the disease. And that's going to be increasingly important, particularly as evidence emerges, which we all hope the people who've had the disease, like a mild case, are at much lower risk from getting sick in the future. If that's the case, we'll be able to know who is at much lower risk. And that could really help, for example, make sure that, you know, we can put doctors and nurses at much lower risk in greater contact with patients. So over time, I think we're going to be able to structure our response to be a lot safer.
Would you expect that this kind of speeded up authorization that the FDA used, that you were the first to use, will be applicable when treatments start to become available?
I think it could well be. I think the FDA will have a few options, but I think it could well be. Now, this is a really important point, especially given that the president seems to be, you know, hearing something might work and then telling everyone to go use it, which I think has created some problems. You know, there are certain medications that patients rely on for example, treating lupus that they can't now find because the president and others are kind of spreading ideas that maybe there'll be a miracle cure for COVID, which they are not a miracle cure for COVID. They've been used extensively and people have not done so much better. We need evidence. Evidence is not red tape. When people say we're going to cut through the red tape and get more treatments, that doesn't make sense. You need evidence. You need to know what works. The purpose isn't to have something to treat you. The purpose is to have something to treat you that actually works. You don't know whether something works unless it's been proven to work. That's why the work at Johns Hopkins, University of Maryland, and others to actually study these things as quickly as possible is literally the difference between life and death. There are many things that people could say, I've got a theory or it works in a test tube. Does it work in patients? We need good answers to that question. And then when we find things that work, we have to be able to scale them and get them out. So if we abandon evidence, we'll be just racing after things that could not only not work, but actually make things worse. And we have to keep our heads about us because it is science that is going to get us through this, I think, and to a large extent. If we're able to find treatments and vaccines, even preventive treatments, and we could talk about some ideas there, that will make a huge difference. That's why we need to shut things down now to buy us time to find those things, the things that work.
Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky announced he had tested positive for COVID-19 over the weekend. He was criticized for using the Senate gym while he was waiting for his test results. Test results can take 2 or 3 days. How should people behave while they're waiting for results?
People should be on their own at home when they're waiting for results. What Rand Paul did was not appropriate. And as a leader, he has to, you know, everybody who is a leader in the public eye has to realize that this applies to him. There's no exemption from the threat that you could get COVID. There's no exemption from the threat that you could pass it on to someone else. You know, he needs, you know, I hope his example is for others that they not act like that, because it's really unfortunate. I mean, he's basically now led all these other people to have to quarantine themselves, but he's also sort of sent out this blasé message that, like, this isn't that big a deal. And, you know, even people who recover are a bridge for the infection to someone who could die. And so by kind of going out and about, he conceivably could have led somebody to get sick who will then get so sick that they may even die. And that is what is at stake here. I mean, people have been sending me these tweets where there are these, like, people with all this bravado, like, everybody is a chicken, but I'm out here, #freedom, #I love America. And they're like, I'm in an airport and I'm this. And then a few days later, it's like, you know, I got to tell you the truth. I've been diagnosed with COVID-19. I can hardly breathe. This is for real. You know, and I understand the American spirit, but there are other parts of the American spirit besides just defying authority. And one of them is coming together and do what's necessary for people who are really at risk. I mean, that person who's running around the airport and getting sick could have made a lot of people sick and some people die. And this is not, you know, a time for that kind of, you know, #bravado.
That's Dr. Joshua Sharfstein of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. We need to take a quick break here on the record. When we're back, a major side effect of this pandemic may be huge medical bills. Dr. Sharfstein has an idea for a crisis insurance program based on Medicare. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. The potential financial impact of COVID-19 is just starting to come into focus. Time magazine reported last week that an uninsured patient diagnosed with COVID-19 was billed $34,000 for the 3 trips to the emergency room it took to diagnose and manage her symptoms. My guest this morning is Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, a pediatrician and associate dean for public health practice and training and professor of the practice at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He previously served as the health commissioner of Baltimore City, the principal deputy commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and the health secretary of the state of Maryland. You wrote an op-ed with your Hopkins colleagues, Gerard Anderson and Jennifer Nuzzo, arguing we should create a public health crisis insurance program to treat patients affected by this pandemic. How would this work?
I think the idea is that it would rely on the administrative structure of Medicare and have a very simple process for doctors, testing centers, hospitals to bill the federal government for COVID-related expenses. And this would have several advantages. The first one is to remove barriers to access to care. We don't want, you know, even before this crisis, you heard stories about people who are coughing in the parking lot to the hospital, trying to figure out whether they feel so sick that they can go in there and risk a bill. We don't want that to happen when it's COVID. It was terrible before, but now it's an imminent public health threat if people are staying at home because they're afraid of the cost of going to the hospital. People need to be identified and treated in order to reduce the spread of the disease. So number one is access. Number two is data. If we had a single source of payment, we would have great data about who's getting sick, where they're getting sick, who's getting tested. That's how some of these countries in Asia have really been able to keep close tabs on the infection. Otherwise, it's very confusing about how to get national data. A third important reason is in order to protect and simplify the way we pay for healthcare. Right now, employers pay for a lot of health care. This could make it harder for employers to hire people if they're now paying for the COVID bills. The insurers, when they built their rates this year to figure out what to charge, they weren't counting on a global pandemic. And so we could be facing insurance company bailouts. It's just much better and clearer to take that that expense off their books. And then the last reason is to have a fair way to make medications and vaccines available. And not just a fair way, a more sustainable funding source for cures for this. Right now, if you're a company and you're working on this, you have no idea whether anyone will buy it at the end of the day. And Medicare is a single purchaser, not Medicare, the federal government using Medicare structure as a single purchaser could basically provide a guarantee of payment for anything that works and really help facilitate the market for different kinds of treatments. And then when things are available, make sure that everybody could have access to them. So we think that there's a lot of value for this. You know, right now there are not as many patients, and we'll just see how the system goes. And we're trying to patch it together as a country. There's states that are allowing people on Medicaid if they don't have insurance. But I think eventually our complex system of health insurance won't be able to sustain a major, major pandemic. And, you know, we'll see how this goes. This is an idea that we put out there, and it may yet have its moments.
Is anybody in elective office picking up on this idea?
Well, we've had a few conversations with people, but I think right now the system is able to handle the cases that have come in so far. I know in New York they're really straining, but we're continuing to make the case, and I think if it as we expect, it gets a lot worse, I think this may well, our phones might be ringing a little bit more on it.
This is On the Record on WIP. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with former Baltimore City Health Commissioner and former Maryland Secretary of Health, Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, about the COVID-19 pandemic. I think you mentioned a few minutes ago preventive treatments that could be helpful. Give me an idea of what those are.
Sure. Well, here's an idea that also, like every kind of treatment, needs evidence for it. But, there's a hope at this point and a reason to believe that the antibodies that people who have recovered may be helpful if they're transfused into people who are at risk of getting infected. So think like healthcare workers, for example. There's evidence, for example, from measles outbreaks that if people got the serum of people who recovered from measles, they're much less likely to get measles in the first place. Now, will that work for coronavirus? There's a professor at the School of Public Health, Arturo Casadevall, who's been working with his colleagues at the School of Medicine at Johns Hopkins to stand up a study very quickly. They're working closely with the FDA on the contours of that study, and hopefully that will be launched very soon, and we could have an answer relatively soon about whether this makes a difference. One of the interesting things about the coronavirus is that, you know, 80% or so of people recover relatively easily. So in theory, there's a pretty big reservoir of people who could donate antibodies if this were to work. Now, having said that, there are also some people who are worried that this approach might actually not work. It could make people sicker. So that's why we do studies to see whether it works first. So, if people are interested in hearing more about this idea, we do have a podcast, Public Health on Call, which you can find wherever you get podcasts. And we did an interview with Dr. Casadevall where he really explains the theory and talks about what he's hoping to find out very soon through research.
And we will link to your podcast from our website. I want to do a rapid fire Q&A about some of the myths and rumors around COVID-19 that are spreading. Will COVID-19 infections decline when warmer weather arrives?
Unknown. We don't know. There's some evidence that maybe it's a little bit less in warmer areas now, I think. But when I put that question to an expert virologist, he said, we can hope for it, but we shouldn't expect it.
Should people who suspect they have COVID-19 avoid ibuprofen?
There are some rumors online about that. I don't think there's any credible evidence for saying that they should do that at this point.
And this is not a myth, but I do want to ask you before I let you go. This is a very stressful time. What advice do you give people coping with fear and anxiety right now?
So, first of all, it's absolutely natural to be anxious and fearful at this point. This is unprecedented in all of our lifetimes to be dealing with this. And so, people shouldn't feel like they're weak because they're anxious. Anxiety is normal, and they should think about the things that they can do to lower their risk and the risk of others. And by taking those steps, how they're really contributing to the health of everyone. I also think it's important to realize that social distancing is really about physical distancing. It's not about emotional distancing. It's not about being distant from calling your parents or your brother or your sister or your friends. It's really important to do everything you can to connect and to share, your fears and to talk through what different people are doing. That's what makes us human. I think one of the coolest things about the coronavirus is the way it isolates us. Even, unfortunately, in death, people have to be on their own because of their isolation. It's just horrible. And so we can't let the virus take away our social nature, even if it forces us to do some physical distancing. And I think that's a really critical thing. We have a great podcast from yesterday all about this issue if people are interested in listening in Public Health on Call.
Dr. Sharfstein, thank you. Joshua Sharfstein, Associate Dean for Public Health Practice and Training and at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you're listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.